Deutsche Welle, World in Progress.
In this program, we find out how a law protecting the king is used to curb freedom of expression in Thailand.
The law allows anyone to levy a lèse majesté charge against anyone else. And the conviction rate is well over 90%.
We learn about the plight of migrants and minorities in San Francisco.
The unemployment rates for Latino and African American populations here in San Francisco, it is in the double digits. And the industries that are traditionally open to our communities are rapidly disappearing.
And we meet an inspiring farmer in Nigeria. Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. On the 30th of April, a verdict is expected for one of Thailand's latest victims of internet censorship. Sihanouk Premchaporn is a renowned internet journalist with an independent web paper. She is accused of not having removed commentaries slandering the Thai king from the paper's internet forum in 2009. Now she could face up to 50 years in prison. The Thai law that prohibits any form of lèse majesté also makes the offence punishable harsher than murder. And it makes freedom of expression an increasingly endangered good in the Kingdom of Thailand, which since the coup of 2006 has increasingly used the lèse majesté rules to crack down on critical voices, particularly on the internet. Sarah Magwood reports from Bangkok. The presenter is Serena Goldenberg.
Sihanouk Premchaporn is a petite, cheerful woman. Her nickname, Diu, means tiny. She doesn't seem to be comfortable in the spotlight with her newfound role as a leader of the battle for press freedom. She would rather just go back to her work. Premchaporn is an online journalist for the independent online newspaper Prachatai. In 2008, unknown persons allegedly posted insulting remarks about the king in the user forum of that website, and now Sihanouk Premchaporn is accused of not having removed them quickly enough. She faces the possibility of up to 50 years in prison.
They say that I intentionally left the comments of the Prachatai web board up longer than necessary. The law doesn't give any rules or regulations for what constitutes too long. Neither are there any practical examples, nor is there any existing jurisprudence.
The American activist CJ Hinckley is the founder of the NGO Freedom Against Censorship Thailand. He's been reporting every day about the hearing on his blog.
In Prachatai, the comments that were made on the website referred to the king as the blind father because he is nearly blind in one eye from a childhood auto accident. The queen was referred to as Mama Blue because, of course, she's the mother of the nation and her royal color is blue. Are these insulting?
Thailand has been a constitutional monarchy since 1932. The king is the most important authority in the entire country. Golden framed pictures of the monarch hang in every public space and even in private homes. Honouring him is the highest duty of every Thai citizen. The so-called lèse majesté law states that anyone who defames, insults or threatens the king, the queen or their heirs will be sentenced to 15 years imprisonment. No concrete definitions of what constitutes an offence are provided. Sihanouk Premchaporn is expected to receive her sentence on April 30th. Her case is highly symbolic and the first one dealing with third-party reliability. In future, people could even be sued for not keeping someone else from insulting the royal family. This would mean that posting a link to an article or liking something on Facebook that criticizes the king would be punishable by law. Benjamin Zawocki from Amnesty International explains that once you've been charged, the chances of being acquitted are slim.
Well, there's a particular provision in the law which allows anyone at all, to levy a lèse majesté charge against anyone else. That charge is handed to the police hand the charge to the Office of the Prosecution, and anyone essentially then can be prosecuted for this law. And the conviction rate is well over 90%. And so essentially, once you are accused, it's virtually as if you are guilty until proven innocent.
The accused generally make a confession quickly in the hope that they can at least get a pardon from the king. Human rights groups say that politicians abuse the law in order to increase their own power. Ever since the coup d'etat in 2006, the law has been used 16 times the rate than before, especially against the opposition and journalists. About 500 cases are taken to court every year. Sean Crispin of the New York non-profit organization Committee to Protect Journalists reads a clear message from the government.
What we've seen is the government, by targeting high-profile individuals with these effectively anti-royal charges, they're trying to send a message to all journalists that this is an area you're not allowed to go to. This is still taboo. And if you dare, tread into this space, you run the risk of similar charges.
Reporters Without Borders view the Lèse Majesté law as a threat to freedom of the press. Strong censorship has been mainly limiting the freedom of opinion online since Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra took office in June 2011. Reporters Without Borders maintain that the politicians are abusing the law. The new government has intensified internet surveillance. Over 600,000 websites are currently blocked, most because of the suspicion of insulting the monarchy. Nearly 700 more are being blocked on a daily basis. A public debate about changing the law wasn't possible for many years. No politician would have dared to bring up the topic. The danger of being reported to the police would have been too great. But despite this problem, critical voices have been growing for about 2 years. Independent groups organise protests, hunger strikes and marches on a regular basis in order to increase pressure on the government. Members of the so-called Red Shirts have been giving a lot of support to these groups. They too have been calling for a reform of the Lèse Majesté law. The UN, the EU, some Thai celebrities and even 8 members of the royal family have been calling for clear reduction of sentences, among other things. Prichan is a 68-year-old member of the Red Shirts. He and other protesters are using unusually critical words these days.
The monarchy is not the god. He is a simple man. So listen to us, talk with us, so we can both go together. But the monarchy and the people surround will not accept this idea. They try to beat us. That's why they think that the people is only the tiny matter under their feet.
King Bhumibol did claim in a speech in 2005 that people should be allowed to criticise him. But that hasn't changed anything so far. Wrestling over the highly sensitive law might become a long process despite the ever-increasing public pressure. Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra has already announced that she will not permit any changes to the law so as not to appear disloyal to the king. A parliamentary committee is currently working on this issue.
That was Rina Goldenberg presenting a report by Sarah Magwood. German development cooperation policy lacks a sound concept to cope with new global challenges. That's the opinion of 2 non-government organizations based in Germany, Deutsche Welthungerhilfe and Terre des Hommes. In their report, Reality of Development Policy, published this week, they point out that the gap between rich and poor countries is increasing, despite billions being put into development cooperation. But German Development Minister Dirk Niebel says the criticism is not justified. Gabriel Bord has this report compiled by DW correspondent Marcel Fürstenau.
Germany, Europe's strongest economy, is the second biggest donor country after the U.S. when it comes to development aid. The latest figures from the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, show Germany invested more than $10 billion in aid for the first time ever last year. The bulk of the funds came from the Federal Ministry for Development and Cooperation, whose total budget comes to some 6.4 billion euros, or about $8.6 billion. Germany also used funds from its Environment Ministry and some of the money it reserved for development credits. In total, Germany's official development aid, or ODA, adds up to 0.4% of the country's GNP. That's almost as much as it was shortly before German reunification in 1990. However, 0.4 is far from the goal of 0.7% that Germany set 20 years ago, which is also what the UN wants donor countries to spend. And critics say that development policy has to improve. In theory, there are some positive developments, but an overall policy for coping with current challenges is still lacking in German development policy. That's according to Wolfgang Jammann, Secretary General of the NGO Welthungerhilfe. He thinks that strengthening the civil society in receiving countries should play a bigger role.
There's too little money, too few long-term projects, too little predictability. Civil society groups in Ghana, India, or Cambodia also need support from donor countries to be able to demand necessities like good governments, the adherence to human rights, and so on.
Germany's Federal Minister for Development, Dirk Niebel, says this kind of criticism is unfounded. He cites Germany's policies on rural development and human rights, which his ministry has implemented since he took office 2.5 years ago. In an interview with DW, Niebel described the accusation that his ministry was not providing sufficient funds as, quote, impertinent. Niebel also defended a strengthening of bilateral cooperation between Germany and particular countries, which NGOs have criticized as not being global enough.
As a matter of fact, in the interest of better coordination, donors concentrate on what they do best, because that leads to very good results and high efficiency. I was one of the leading forces in introducing the so-called joint programming of the European Union. That means in development work, there's a process of coordination between EU member countries and fragile states, because they're simply overwhelmed with too many donors.
Niebel also stressed that by far the largest part of the funds was put to multinational cooperation, for instance, through the World Bank. However, his critics from the NGO sector are not convinced. Jammann, the general secretary of Welthungerhilfe, says that some of the minister's ideas are good, but they remain theoretical instead of being put in practice. One example is the increased inclusion of private enterprises in development cooperation, a practice that Niebel has been pushing for.
Countries in Africa and Asia with positive growth and development at this time leave more and more poor people out. The gap in incomes of rich and poor people is increasing more and more in these countries. And that's a development which the general policy of the German federal government does not account for.
But in Minister Niebel's view, the NGOs are too one-sided in their criticism.
Even if we mean well, we can only fight poverty when we help our partner countries grow their economies. That can be done through more jobs and income, which earn taxes for the state, and that delivers funding for basic services like health, education and infrastructure.
Still, Danuta Zacher, chairperson of the NGO Terre des Hommes, argues that the German government should try to find more sources for funds to make development cooperation more effective. One of those sources could come from higher taxation of international financial markets.
Taxing financial transactions would be a promising source of additional development aid. Also, there are revenues from international emissions trading. We've been demanding that at least half of these revenues should go to development aid, but it's simply not the case.
Even stronger criticism for Germany's development policy comes from the left party, Die Linke. Heike Hensel, the party's speaker for development cooperation, accused Minister Niebel and the government of not learning from the current economic and financial crisis. She argued that by making German development cooperation increasingly subject to the market, instead of helping people in developing nations, the main gain was for German companies who get access to new customers, investments, and resources. Gabriel Borud, DW.
Still coming up here on World in Progress, a report about poor and middle-class people being driven out of San Francisco. But first, here's Nigel Tandy with a look at some development news.
Pakistani welfare scheme successful. In Pakistan, a welfare scheme for the country's poorest is beginning to show signs of success. The government-backed program comes in the form of a debit card that is topped up with the equivalent of $30 every 3 months. That's enough to put an extra daily meal on the table, buy a school uniform, or pay for medical treatment in a country where soaring food and fuel costs are hurting millions. The program, named after Benazir Bhutto, is something of a success story for a government widely seen as corrupt and inefficient, as well as for international donors that help implement and fund it. A Catholic priest from the Philippines, a mother of three from Argentina, and the founder of the NGO Friends of Lake Turkana in Kenya all have one thing in common. They have helped to motivate their respective local communities to protect the natural environment around them and to stand up for their rights. Water is a special focus of this year's prize, with two of the winners being outstanding river activists. For Ikal Angalai, the prize comes at an important juncture in her struggle to stop construction of the massive Jibe 2 dam in Ethiopia. EU pledges extra funds for energy in developing nations. The European Union vowed fresh funds on Monday to help developing nations provide sustainable energy to 500 million people by 2030. Speaking at a sustainable energy summit, EU Commission President José Manuel Barroso pledged €50 million over 2 years for technical assistance and said EU nations would seek hundreds of millions of euros more to support investments in sustainable energy for developing countries. UN Chief Ban Ki-moon welcomed what he described as a very ambitious initiative in the run-up to the UN Conference on Sustainable Development in Rio in June. The United Nations estimates that one in five people lives without access to electricity. Drought Conference seeks long-term solution to cyclical drought. Delegates at a conference in Nairobi aimed at fighting a long-term solution to cyclical drought in Africa, which wraps up on Friday, have agreed to reforest much of East Africa's farmland over the coming decade. The Beating Famine Conference, organised by aid agency World Vision, along with the World Agroforestry Centre, sought to build support for practical low-cost techniques that reverse land degradation and deforestation, thus increasing production on farms. The United Nations says 15 million people in the Sahel face food shortages.
That was Nigel Tandy with some development news. Millions of people have been suffering from drought last year in East Africa. Now, failing rains threaten to impact the region with more problems. Many people blame climate change. Using land to produce plants for biofuels rather than food, agricultural mismanagement and lack of proper food storage facilities. But in Nigeria, one man is searching for new answers to the continent's food shortages. Olatunji Akomolafe has spent 25 years working with and teaching farmers and young people about sustainable agriculture at the Village Pioneer Project. Jamilu Sani and Adamu Ibrahim Dabo from Kano State Radio and Deutsche Welle's Stefanie Duckstein visited the project. Sean Sinico presents their report.
So we are now at the VPP house.
If you ask Atunji Akumalafa, we're standing at the very spot of green grass in southern Nigeria where a revolution took place. His revolution, in the town of Ajua.
So this is my tree, the first tree to be planted, and that signifies the revolution for tree planting and the starting point of a revolution, that is starting from the bottom. One tree per family. So if we have about 1 million families in Nigeria and every family plants one tree, we have 1 million trees.
The Village Pioneer Project, or VPP, is a world where everything is connected. Fruit trees grow next to herbs, and palms reach into the sky near a training garden sown with native plants. Akumulaufa's idea was born 2.5 decades ago to create a place where the collected knowledge of generations of farmers could be married to modern agricultural techniques.
The technology here is small man technology. Simple man technology. Because we must get some people who are interested in the small people. And the majority of the people in this country are small subsistence farmers, and they must be taken care of.
About two-thirds of Nigeria's 156 million people work in farming. But poverty, rural depopulation, and a brain drain are all making it increasingly difficult to live off the land. Akumulaufa, who studied agriculture in Germany, says the Village Pioneer Project is trying to reverse the trend.
This organization was set up mainly to combat the escape of young people from rural community to the urban centers. You see, before the oil boom, the rural population was over 80% of the population of Africa and Nigeria in particular. But when the oil was discovered, the drift into the urban centers started. But when the oil boom collapsed after 1982, the situation changed. Many people who went to the big cities could not get enough jobs. Then they were stranded, either stranded or they ended up in slums. So after my master's degree in agriculture, I decided to go back and combat, in my own small way, part of the problem.
Akumalaufa and his team of about 40 have trained nearly 2,600 young people to be farmers, animal breeders, smiths, or like Christina Asha, weavers.
Right now, I'm separating the seeds from the cotton wool with this plate and small iron fork. When the cotton is fresh off the plant, the seeds still stick to the fibers. We pluck the cotton balls and remove the dirt. Then we card it, then we can spin it. After that, it's ready to be dyed. Red, white, blue, yellow. Then it's ready to be woven in a loom. I learn weaving here in the VPP. Not even my parents can do this. I like it.
Akumalaufa also brought in beekeepers from Greece to show the Ajula locals like Olushoa Sheyasula how to become apiarists.
I was trained as a beekeeper. The price of honey in the market now is increasing and we have less people producing honey. So if I begin to produce honey for the market, it's enough for me.
Akumalaufa says he knows the Village Pioneer Project has improved many people's lives, but he adds that he won't be satisfied until African countries are productive enough to be able to sustain themselves without outside aid.
By now, Africans will be able to sanitize Africa. So if any country is experiencing drought or war, by now I expect African nations to be able to gather food on its own to feed its people. Not waiting for Americans or Europeans or Asians to gather food and fly with iron plate here to be distributing food to Africa who are hungry. It's a shame.
And our last report today takes us to the west coast of the United States. Like all great world cities, San Francisco is an attractive destination for tourists, high-tech firms and workers from all walks of life. Many are hoping to improve their lives in this diverse and thriving environment. However, the city's popularity does have a downside. The cost of living has become so high that it's chasing away middle and low-income immigrants and minorities who, up until now, have had a huge part in the city's success. Our reporter Max Pringle has more.
Millions of people come from all over the world each year to enjoy San Francisco's postcard views, rumbling antique cable cars, and majestic bridges. The city is also a high-tech hub. Twitter, Zynga, and other well-known tech firms call it home, bringing their well-compensated employees with them. That's a good thing for the city's economy, right? Well, it depends on who you ask. Low- and middle-income San Franciscans say the city should be doing more to help create the kind of jobs that will let them stay a part of the city where they work and live.
We're having people drop off job applications for City Hall to invest in our success and create better job strategies and workforce development strategies for low-income working class communities of color.
That's Christina Kanya Varal. She's the economic justice campaign organizer for Coleman Advocates for Children and Youth, a community group advocating for immigrant and minority residents. A recent analysis by the real estate brokerage firm Jones Lang LaSalle estimates that the number of tech jobs in San Francisco will soon surpass the record of 34,000 set in the year 2000, or about one in five office jobs. That's nearly double the number of tech jobs in 2004. But Kanya Varal says those high-tech jobs are leaving some residents out.
The unemployment rates are what they seem. And for Latino and African-American populations here in San Francisco, it is in the double digits. It is over 10%. And the industries that are traditionally open to our communities are rapidly disappearing. And industries that cater to a more affluent community are taking their place. And so families are being pushed out of San Francisco because of this.
Our future!
All right, now who's ready to turn in some applications?
City officials say they are working with community organizations to try to connect residents from disadvantaged groups with local businesses and job opportunities. Jane Kim is a member of the Board of Supervisors, which serves as San Francisco's city council.
So we're working closely with those tech companies, and we want to work with all of you that are here today to make sure that they're starting internship programs, so we're developing a pipeline of youth into our existing and growing economic sectors.
Mayor Ed Lee made job creation a central plank in his election campaign last fall. He helped convince Twitter to keep its 2,000 jobs in the city after it announced its intention to leave last year. But he says keeping large firms in the city is only one part of his plan.
Small and medium-sized businesses, they're the engine of job creation right now. They want to cut the red tape out. They want to figure out how they can be matched with some good financial incentives. And so the other idea that we have is to create a $5 million small business revolving loan fund.
According to the San Francisco Comptroller's Office, which monitors the city's finances, the per capita yearly income for San Francisco residents jumped from over $58,000 per year in 2004 to over $74,000 per year in 2008. That's creating higher housing costs in an already tight market, making it tough for lower-income residents to make ends meet. Advocates for immigrant, minority, and low-income residents say the mayor's job creation policies need improvement.
We really feel like the mayor needs to take a stronger position, you know, with these big corporations.
Gordon Marr is with the group Jobs with Justice.
Whether it's high-tech companies like Twitter or huge hospital corporations like CPMC Sutter Health, and require them to adhere to really strong local hire commitments and also support for workforce development programs that would support, you know, disadvantaged San Francisco residents getting the training and support they need to have equal access to the job opportunities that he and these big companies are supposedly creating.
In response, the city has announced the Tech SF initiative. It uses a $5 million federal grant to train an initial 1,800 or so San Franciscans for IT jobs. The city promises more in the future. Mozilla and Salesforce.com are among the firms signed on as partners. But it's not only the influx of affluent workers to the area that's causing a middle-class exodus. The economic crisis caused foreclosure rates to skyrocket nationwide as bad home loans collapsed, causing mortgage payments to balloon. San Francisco was no exception. Bayview District resident Vivian Richardson nearly lost her home as she struggled for 2 years to renegotiate her loan with Deutsche Bank, her mortgage lender. Nearly out of options, she went to the Alliance for Californians for Community Involvement for help.
That organization supported me in my efforts to get, you know, stop the foreclosure, and they actually set up an email blast.
Richardson says the emails really got Deutsche Bank's attention.
That email blast generated 1,400 emails in a matter of 2 hours, several hundred phone calls. After the first half an hour of that email blast, I received a phone call from Aurora Loans, which is the servicer of my account. They called to let me know that they hear me, they want to be in communication with me.
Richardson says she hopes her story can inspire low-income residents and minorities fighting to stay put in San Francisco and other great world cities. For DW, I'm Max Pringle in San Francisco.
And that wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. For more stories on globalization and development, go to our webpage at dw.de/globalization. Thanks for tuning in today. I hope you liked the show and that you'll join me again next week at the same time. Until then, on behalf of the studio team here in Bonn, I'm Anke Raspa saying thanks for listening and goodbye.